Businesses around Glacier Park are feeling the pinch of the park's closure. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why C-SPAN is hanging out in Helena. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a state water expert about the new state water plan. Businesses around the closed Glacier Park are feeling the pinch from the government shutdown. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry checks with several local businesses, many of which are heading into winter mode early this year.
About the only thing hopping in West Glacier this week is the school. The fall is generally winding down season as services in Glacier Park winterize. Many businesses are already closed, boarded up, and shut down for the season. But Paul Doherty was planning to keep working at the gas station, gift shop, restaurant, lodge at the Glacier Highlander Resort until the end of the month.
I walked into the restaurant one day to get coffee before I had to go to work. And our wholesale representative was sitting at the counter, and he turned around and said to me, "What are you still doing here?" And I said, "I'm here until we close." And he said, "Sunday?" And I didn't even put my bag or my coat down. I turned around and went and found my boss in the store, asked if we were closing Sunday, and he said, "Yep."
Doherty says that was a couple of days after the park shut down, and they closed up shop last weekend. He says they had planned to stay open through the 20th of October. Now he's heading back home to California after his first season of working in West Glacier.
It was quite a shock to my mom to find out in August that I was going to be here until Halloween. She was a little too happy that I was had a reason to come home early now.
Darwin Stoneman is owner and one of the original founders of Glacier Raft Company in West Glacier, which started up in 1976. Stoneman says fishing and rafting are done this time of year, and they've closed up the retail shop, but they still offer cabin rentals.
I'd say we've had, close to 50% cancellation here in the last few weeks due to the government shutdown and the park being closed, which I think is absurd. They could leave the gate open and let people visit the park. It's really the American public's park. It's not the government's.
Stoneman says they have 12 cabins and can sleep about 30 people. He says generally they're completely full in August, about 75% occupancy in September, and it drops off quickly as October progresses, down to about nothing by the end of the month. The season kicks into gear in June.
For us, we have such a short season, and any little bit helps.
Director of the Whitefish Convention and Visitors Bureau, Jan Metzmaker, says her organization started up in 2006 specifically to work on promoting the shoulder seasons of spring and fall.
If we can get our businesses to just be a little more successful in those shoulder seasons, they can keep their employees longer and, they're just have a better year. You can't cram a whole business into July and August, so...
Metzmaker says she's hearing feedback from hotels dealing with visitors who planned their whole trip on being in the Flathead in the fall.
And fall is such a great time to be in the Flathead and with fall colors and, not as many people. It's more relaxed. And so we really emphasize that kind of secret season when you're here without the tourists.
Carla Fisher manages the Montana Coffee Traders Cafe in Columbia Falls. She says they stayed busier through September than they have in a while.
So we actually, our numbers were definitely up more so than they had been for the last couple years, and we think part of that was the weather stayed nice and the road was still open.
Rehabilitation on the Going to the Sun Road has been closing sections of the road on the west side before snow shuts it down. Fisher says locals and visitors alike frequent the cafe. As the summer season winds down, they start seeing more locals again. She says they've been talking with many visitors about what else to do.
There was lots of consternation and shock and disbelief that they weren't able to get into the park. So we tried, we offered different places for them to go. There's still plenty of things to do, even if you can't actually get into the park.
Fisher mentions a drive up the North Fork Road, which runs along the river and gives views of Glacier's peaks. This is a message Metzmaker says they're also trying to get across in Whitefish.
There's many places in the area where people can still ride their bikes, walk, hike, walk down to the lake, and we have a lot of pedestrian and bike paths. So there are opportunities, but, the crowning glory is Glacier Park, and it's just unfortunate they can't even, get in the door. It's very, very frustrating.
As the fall colors overtake the larch, birch, and brush on the mountainsides in this part of western Montana, many seasonal businesses are already closed or scaled back to fall hours. Other businesses are just starting to get geared up as snow brushing the top of the mountains hints at the next season. A seasoned Metz maker says they're also working to grow. Ski season. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
U.S. Senator Max Baucus says he thinks Congress is inching closer to a solution to end the government shutdown and avoid a federal financial default. The Montana Democrat said today he believes members of Congress are starting to listen to constituents and understand the standoff must end. The Senate Finance Committee chairman heard earlier in the day from the Treasury Secretary that failure to raise the debt limit would be catastrophic to financial markets and business. Republicans opened the door to a short-term extension, but also said they want to talk about cuts to the government's big benefit programs such as Social Security and Medicare. Baucus said that topic can only be discussed as part of an orderly, longer-term conversation that also includes raising revenue through closing tax loopholes.
And in other news from around the state, the board that runs the state's public employee pension says the legislature's fix should balance the system in about 16 years. A report given to the Montana Public Employees Retirement Board today projects all future payments into and out of the system. It analyzed the effect of the changes that asked both employers and employees to pay more while reducing retiree benefits. Before, the system never balanced and eventually ran out of money. But retirees are planning to file a lawsuit that argues their benefit reduction is an unconstitutional change in contract. If successful, the report says it will take more than 40 years to balance the system. A recent report on the separate teachers' retirement system says the legislative fix balances the program in about 20 years.
Governor Steve Bullock is touting the latest ranking of state tax climates to show Montana is a good place for business. The Tax Foundation released a ranking saying Montana was ranked as having the seventh best tax climate in the study, up one spot from last year. The nonpartisan tax research group highlighted Montana as a state with no sales tax. Bullock, a Democrat, says that the tax ranking, along with the trained workforce and high quality of life, helps make Montana a great place to do business. Republican State Senator Fred Thomas says the GOP needs credit for cutting taxes in the 1990s and early 2000s. He points out that the legislation earlier this year further cutting the business equipment tax came from Republican lawmakers.
A federal judge has rejected a bid to reopen a scenic two-lane highway in northern Idaho so a General Electric Company subsidiary can resume shipments of massive oil field equipment. U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill issued the decision Thursday in the latest battle over use of U.S. Highway 12 as a shipping route for the wide, long, and heavy loads. Last month, Windmill issued an injunction that essentially blocked the company from hauling the megaloads through a federal protected wild and scenic river corridor. The company asked the judge to reconsider the decision, arguing it could lose millions of dollars if the equipment doesn't arrive at the oil sands in Canada on schedule.
A 27-year-old Missoula man is among 13 people indicted for being members of the hacking group Anonymous that has targeted the websites of groups or businesses that oppose the Anonymous philosophy of making all information free for everyone, regardless of copyright laws or national security issues. The Missoulian reports 27-year-old Wade Carl Williams and the others are charged with conspiracy to intentionally damage protected computers. He made an initial appearance in U.S. District Court in Great Falls on October 4th and is scheduled to appear in federal court in Virginia tomorrow. The indictment alleges that from September 2010 to January 2011, Anonymous members flooded websites with internet traffic to shut them down. Their targets included groups and law firms that help protect intellectual property rights.
A Canadian man is charged with felony criminal endangerment after his black BMW was clocked traveling just over double the posted speed limit on Interstate 90 in South Central Montana. The Stillwater County News reports 31-year-old Samuel Ryan Curlett was stopped by a Montana Highway Patrol trooper shortly after 8 a.m. Saturday after another driver reported someone had passed him traveling about 150 miles per hour. Patrol radar clocked him at 154. Curlett, who lives in Adrie, Alberta, just north of Calgary, made an initial appearance in Stillwater County Justice Court in Columbus on Monday. He posted a $25,000 bond and is scheduled to enter a plea in district court on October 17th. Patrol Sergeant Scott Ayers of Billings says the criminal endangerment charge was filed because Curlett almost hit another vehicle.
A Ronan family is asking for help locating five unbranded horses they believe were stolen from a fenced area south of Ronan. Victoria and Kevin Templer say they took a dozen horses to leased land on the Chef Guest Ranch on September 19th. When they returned from a hunting trip on September 30th, they could only find seven of the horses. The Templers waited several days, put out some hay, and eventually searched the entire property. The horses were gone, no gates were open, and the fence was intact. Victoria Templer says they've never branded their horses because they didn't want to hurt them. State brand inspectors told her that may make it more difficult to prove the horses are theirs if they are found.
A 40-year-old Anaconda man who was on parole on a burglary charge has been arrested by police investigating a rash of burglaries in three counties. Anaconda Police Chief Tim Barkell tells the Montana Standard that officers investigating a suspicious vehicle saw stolen items in Ronald Lumen's Jeep, while cash and more stolen goods were found at his home. Lumen was charged yesterday with seven felony counts of burglary in Anaconda. Burkell says Lumen is a suspect in three burglaries in Powell County and two business burglaries in Butte. Lumen's criminal history includes an arson conviction for a 1991 church fire in Billings that caused $200,000 worth of damage. He was suspected of setting several other serious fires in Billings in 1994, on the night before he was sentenced in the arson case.
The estate of a woman who died in a drunken driving crash is suing an East Helena bar, alleging bartenders continued to serve alcohol to the already intoxicated driver in the hours before the crash. The Independent Record reports the lawsuit was filed on September 20th in Helena by the grandfather of Devin Ricchetti's children, who is a representative of her estate. The lawsuit alleges the VFW Club of East Helena continued to serve 31-year-old Brandy Dullum on December 8, 2011, after employees knew or should have known she was drunk. After the bar closed, Dullum, Ricchetti, and another woman got in a car and headed toward Helena. Dullum was driving at speeds of up to 100 miles per hour when she lost control of the car and it crashed, killing Ricchetti and injuring the other woman.
A Billings woman who reportedly called 911 and said she was too drunk to get out of her vehicle is charged with felony driving under the influence. The Billings Gazette reports 55-year-old Carol Frances O'Mara made an initial appearance in Yellowstone County Justice Court yesterday. She remained jailed today on a $3,000 bond. O'Mara was arrested Tuesday night after a woman called dispatchers and said she couldn't get out of her vehicle. The dispatcher asked if she was having medical or mechanical issues. Court records say the caller replied that she was too drunk. Prosecutors say O'Mara's blood alcohol level was 0.311%, nearly four times the limit at which a person is considered legally intoxicated. Court records say O'Mara has three previous DUI convictions and had the keys to the vehicle in her pocket.
A couple of dark navy blue C-SPAN vans are driving around Helena this week. The cable network is producing a series of segments on the capital city to air in November. Capital reporter Dan Boyce tells us C-SPAN is looking to capture the city's history as well as its cultural and literary life.
For my purposes, I'll just have you spell your first and last name for me.
A C-SPAN production crew is filming an interview at the Montana Historical Society in a gallery of C.M. Russell paintings. The network, normally known for providing live coverage of congressional activities in the nation's capital, has been traveling the country for the last couple of years.
To provide our audience with an inside look into these cities that otherwise wouldn't be seen on a national audience.
That's producer Debbie Lamb. She and the rest of the crew are darting around Helena in their navy blue vans. They call them local content vehicles. They'll be producing about a half dozen short segments on Helena's history and another half dozen on the nonfiction literary culture of the town. It's part of what's called the C-SPAN Cities Tour. 20 mid-sized communities will be featured over the course of this year. Lamb says the preparation begins months in advance, making initial contacts, setting up segments like one they're doing on the state capitol with nonfiction authors or here in this Charlie Russell gallery in the Historical Society.
Try to keep the questions as the how, why, when, what, and where, and let the individuals tell us the story.
C-SPAN will also be interviewing elected officials like Mayor Jim Smith and Governor Steve Bullock for a segment on the community's contemporary life. Lamb says the 15 or more segments will range from 5 to 15 minutes in length. They will air on C-SPAN affiliate networks Book TV and American History TV November 2nd and 3rd, which C-SPAN is calling its Helena Weekend. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Montana officials want to make salvaging roadkill for the dinner table and as easy as a mouse click. State officials plan to let drivers who accidentally kill big game to print out permits at home to allow them to harvest the meat for food. Later on, there will be an app for that, too. State lawmakers earlier this year passed a bill allowing motorists to salvage the carcasses of deer, elk, moose, and antelope struck by vehicles. They left it to the State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Agency to sort out how to issue roadkill permits. Wildlife commissioners approved regulations today that allow people to go online for permits. Spokesman Ron Asheim says there are plans in the works for a smartphone application for permits as well.
The Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation has launched an initiative to update the state's water plan. Scoping meetings are being held in each of Montana's major river basins, with meetings for the Clark Fork Basin starting next Tuesday, October 15th. In tonight's feature with Edward O'Brien, Michael Downey, the supervisor of the Water Planning Section in the DNRC's Water Resources Division, explains some of the fundamental goals of the initiative, starting with Montana's water plan itself.
DNRC was directed in statute to put together a state water plan starting way back in 1973 with the Montana Water Use Act. So water planning in Montana is something that's been going on for quite some time and actually certainly predates even that 1973 date.
So then this initiative essentially takes a second look at all the many and varied issues that focus on water, yeah?
That's correct. In 2009, the Montana State Legislature specifically directed DNRC to prepare a state water plan to be delivered to the 2015 Montana Legislature.
Well, what are some of the key issues? I'm sure they're familiar to many Montanans, but maybe not to everybody. What are some of the issues that you all are taking a look at and that Montanans deal with on a daily basis?
Well, I think the big issue that we're dealing with right now is just really trying to get a handle on our water supply and our level of water consumption that we have throughout the state. I think that some might think that those things are well known, but in fact, it takes a great deal of water resource information, and mostly in the form of gauging stations and the like, that are expensive to operate. And I think it's fair to say that probably Montana hasn't invested in the level of infrastructure that some other states have in order to know our water resources.
Infrastructure including what, just more gauges, you mean?
Well, yeah, more gauges is certainly a really big one in terms of just knowing how much water we have on a daily basis coming from our trip and going into our major rivers. Certainly the USGS has a gauging network, and a big part of our budget is a cooperative arrangement that we have with USGS for running those gauges. But if you look across Montana, certainly a great deal of the water use that goes on is on our smaller tributaries as well as our larger rivers.
What do we know about the demands being placed on our waterways in Montana? I assume it's going nowhere but up.
It's going. I think it's fair to say that it's going nowhere but up. And I think in particularly on the west side of the divide, as we see certainly population increases and increased demand for industrial water use, for all kinds of water use. Probably one of the biggest challenges that we're going to be faced with, especially in the West, is the timing of our water and how our water comes out of the mountains. It's coming out a lot earlier than it used to be as a result of primarily changes in climate.
So what does that mean? What are the implications?
Well, the implication there is, whereas normally we'd have a cold spring where we build up our snowpack and come June, things start to warm up. And then throughout the summer, that water slowly comes out of the hills and feeds our rivers. Instead, we're getting our snowpack isn't as great, and more of our precipitation is coming as rain in the early spring instead of snow. And so for the last couple of years, we're seeing our peak flows as early as late May and in very early June.
Overall, Mr. Downey, how is our water quality in Montana?
You know, Montana, we are blessed with great water quality. Certainly there's room for improvement there, but compared to many states around the country, we have such a plethora of good, clean water. This effort won't be looking at water quality as much. I suspect that certainly with the public, that's going to be an issue that comes up. This is really a water quantity analysis, but all in all, our water quality in the state is great.
This initiative is also described as transforming the Montana State Water Plan into more of a dynamic guide, I understand. And if that's correct, dynamic in this case means what?
Well, I think that we're trying to put together a set of recommendations that really addresses some of the immediate needs for dealing with our water resources. I think that sometimes it's hard to get wrapped around the idea of what water planning is. And it's really, how do we better manage a diminishing water supply? I think if you look around the state, we've got some great examples where at the watershed level, here on the west side, certainly the Upper Clark Fork and the Blackfoot come to mind, where in that case, the Blackfoot Challenge has done great work in working with both DNRC and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and area ranchers to put together a program whereby when water gets low, we can manage that water resource better to satisfy the needs of all, including fish and wildlife.
So everyone making sacrifices, maybe closing
exactly.
Fishing, not irrigating.
Exactly. And having good water resource information really helps the collaboration that needs to go on to make that work.
Meetings already held in the Yellowstone Basin this spring, right?
That's correct.
Pretty big turnout?
Yeah, we had a good turnout. We had a good turnout, and I think that a lot of what we're getting through these meetings is helping to educate the public about our water resources. And then hearing from the public in terms of what their concerns are. So whether you're a sportsman and you're worried about fish and wildlife, or a recreationist and worried about floater passage on our area rivers, or you're an irrigator and how do you irrigate your crops through the season.
And now attention focusing on the Clark Fork Basin.
You bet.
What's the process?
Well, we're starting out with what we're calling a public scoping process, where we're going out and holding public meetings around the basin just to solicit public comment on what their areas of concern are. So really trying to identify, are there areas of concern that the public has that maybe we're not aware of?
And after scoping comes what?
And then after scoping, well, in the Clark Fork Task Force was actually identified by the legislature to be the citizen body that would look at that data, see what the public has said, and then help us put together some recommendations to update the state water plan and make recommendations to the legislature. So the Clark Fork Task Force is comprised of 20 members that really have a broad representation throughout the many stakeholders that make up our water resource interests. So fish and wildlife, agriculture, certainly timber and mining, tribal interests, the irrigation community. We really, really tried our best to get a broad spectrum of individuals represented on that group.
Okay, so lots of meetings coming up, really too much information to pass along in this format in one sitting. Where can people go, though, to find out more if they want to participate?
You bet. They can certainly go to DNRC's website, where they can find information on the state water plan. And if they just go to mt.gov/DNRC, they can find that information there. And they can also come to one of our meetings, where we'll be handing out loads of information, as well as there's in the Clark Fork, there will be an online survey as well, if they can't make one of their meetings. We have a meeting coming up here in Missoula on Tuesday, and Hamilton on Thursday evenings. And from there, we go to Deer Lodge on the 24th, and then Kootenai and Kalispell on the 29th and 30th.
All right. So there are lots of important issues out there, perhaps none more important to us than our future water supplies and quality.
That's exactly right. If you think of what Montana, and certainly what Western Montana would be without our water resources, it'd be a much different place. And so I think our ability to successfully manage those water resources, certainly given a changing climate and more frequent drought, is really critical to preserving our lifestyle here in Montana.
Michael Downey, supervisor of the water planning section in the DNRC's Water Resources Division. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the night, expect mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain and lows in the upper 20s and mid-30s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies and highs in the upper 40s to mid-50s. For central to Montana tonight, there calls for mostly cloudy skies, scattered rain and snow with lows 30 to 35. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies in the morning, becoming partly cloudy and chance of rain and snow through the day, highs 40 to 55. For southwest Montana tonight, you should have mostly cloudy skies in the evening, becoming partly cloudy with scattered rain, snow throughout the night. Lows 25 to 35, and tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies, slight chance of rain and snow through the day. Highs 40 to 50. And now for the editorial comments of Gwen Lagold.
When I fly, I try to get a window seat so I can get a bird's eye view of America. In the past 30 years, that view has changed. Vast landscapes have been transformed into industrial zones for oil and gas production. For as far as the eye can see, large portions of Wyoming, Colorado, North Dakota, New Mexico, Texas, Pennsylvania, and other states are now industrial grids of well pads, pipeline corridors, compressor stations, and roads. Sometimes it's hard to see the homes, schools, farms, and ranches for the oil and gas infrastructure. I live in southwestern Colorado, near the New Mexico border. Our states, like Wyoming and Montana, have abundant reserves of oil and gas. Colorado and New Mexico have tens of thousands of oil and gas wells already, and the bird's eye view of our region is changing as I speak. Layered on top of historical oil and gas fields is a new and more intensive development, shale. Once thought too deep and too expensive to produce, advances in horizontal hydraulic fracturing have allowed companies to tap shale oil and gas reserves thousands of feet below the surface. These wells require more land, more water, and more chemicals for drilling and fracking. When the public demands standards that protect water, air, and public health, the industry is quick to dismiss concerns that their activities threaten our water and air. Instead, they tell people with dozens or hundreds of wells in their communities that it's in the national interest to produce energy and be energy independent. Without question, the people living in America's oil and gas producing regions are doing their part. Those who bear the burden of energy production deserve the most protective regulations possible. That said, there are many people who challenge the notion that regulation is an answer to the impacts caused by oil and gas drilling. For many people, the answer is to simply stop drilling for oil and gas or to ban fracking. But that's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen without a national energy policy and the political will to transition to a clean and renewable energy future. For 25 years, I've worked with communities across the country to prevent and minimize oil and gas impacts. We've organized diverse coalitions to pass several precedent-setting laws and regulations. Hard-won regulations are a small piece of the puzzle in the constant and difficult fight to not only require but achieve mandatory best practices and real protections for people and air and water quality, all in the face of a powerful and highly polluting industry. Yet if we stop fighting for such measures and take up the ban fracking banner as our one answer, we abandon communities in the oil and gas patch, and we lose a key mechanism to hold companies accountable for the harm they cause. Regulations that require well setbacks from homes and rivers, light and noise limits, use of emission preventers, and non-toxic fracking fluids help ensure that companies take environmental impacts and public health into account. A rapidly changing climate and extreme weather are making more and more people question whether developing more polluting fossil fuels is the right thing to do. Wells are being drilled in people's backyards, on farms and ranches, next to schools, and in watersheds that provide drinking water and wildlife habitat. Most people are shocked to learn that the oil and gas industry is exempt from many of our federal environmental laws. For example, fracking is exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act. The oil and gas industry's track record has been abysmal. Drilling has never been proven safe, and it may never be. I know that it certainly won't as long as the industry continues to obstruct attempts to adequately study and regulate its activities. And as long as it is allowed in the absence of strong enforcement to essentially police itself. In the meantime, for those who live with oil and gas development in their backyards, it's not asking much to require that companies fully comply with all parts of the nation's bedrock environmental laws, like the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and to stop obstructing efforts to update and strengthen local and state regulations. I wonder what the bird's eye view of America will be 30 years from now. In Durango, Colorado, I'm Gwen Lackel for the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. Please join me in Hamilton during the last weekend in October for AERO's 39th annual meeting. Get meeting details and register online at aeromt.org.
Gwen Lackelt is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.